If you have severe depression, standard medicine usually gives you a very straightforward but honestly pretty frustrating set of instructions.
Take this daily pill and, just wait.
Right, exactly. You wait 6 long weeks for traditional SSRIs to slowly build up your serotonin levels, just hoping that eventually the dark cloud might lift. But what if I told you the absolute fastest way to reboot a depressed brain, like bringing relief in just 2 hours, involves either a 1960s battlefield anesthetic or, wild as this sounds, an 18th century laughing gas?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a bizarre alternate history of
It
medicine.
really does.
But the reality is, these two remarkably old, highly unconventional substances are currently rewriting our entire understanding of how depression actually lives in the brain, and more importantly, how fast we can pull someone out of it.
Which brings us directly to today's deep dive. We are exploring a fascinating, and I mean really comprehensive, July 2026 article from the OTW Journal. It's titled "Ketamine versus Nitrous Oxide: How Two NMDA Antagonists Race the Depressed Brain."
It's a great piece.
It really is. And our mission today is to unpack how these two radically different molecules are just breaking all the old rules of psychiatry. We're going to look at the hidden mechanics of how they work, why they operate at breakneck speeds, and the very different, sometimes really dangerous costs that come with using them.
Because there are always costs.
Always. Okay, let's unpack this, because to truly grasp what a paradigm shift this is for you or anyone dealing with mental health, we need a picture of just how different this approach is. If standard SSRI pills are like a slow, heavy cargo ship just inching its way across the ocean to nudge your serotonin levels, these two drugs, ketamine and nitrous oxide, they're like rocket ships. They operate on a completely different biological fuel system.
What's fascinating here is that despite looking and feeling completely different to the person actually taking them, they share a very specific chemical identity.
The NMDA thing, right?
Right. They are both what we call non-competitive NMDA receptor antagonists. In plain terms, both of these drugs can take a patient trapped in severe treatment-resistant depression and start reversing those symptoms in as little as 2 hours.
That's staggering.
Think about that difference for a second. 2 hours compared to 42 days of waiting.
Yeah.
But as the ODTW piece meticulously details, their similarities basically vanish the exact moment they enter the human bloodstream.
Well, I want to start with that shared doorway you just mentioned, that NMDA receptor, because the neuroscience detailed in this article is just wild. Standard antidepressants, like we said, target monoamines. They try to pool up serotonin or norepinephrine in the brain.
The old cargo ship method.
Right. But ketamine and nitrous oxide ignore that system entirely. Instead, they bypass serotonin and head straight for the brain's glutamate system. Now, from what I gather, glutamate is the brain's main excitatory neurotransmitter. It's the spark plug.
It is the chemical that makes neurons fire and talk to each other.
Yeah. And this NMDA receptor is essentially the main gateway for that glutamate to do its job. So both ketamine and nitrous oxide work by physically blocking the ion channel of that NMDA receptor.
They act like a wedge shoved under a door, and when they block that specific receptor, it triggers a massive downstream chain reaction.
Like a cascade.
Exactly. The brain responds with a sudden, overwhelming surge of glutamate, which then spills over and activates a secondary receptor called AMPA.
And the article points to this AMPA activation as sort of the holy grail of this whole process.
It really is the critical turning point, because when you activate that AMPA receptor, you kick off an incredible cascade of neuroplasticity. The brain releases something called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
BDNF.
You can think of BDNF as, well, basically a highly concentrated fertilizer for your neural pathways.
Now, the article also threw around another term in that same breath, something called MTOR. I get the fertilizer analogy for BDNF, but how does MTOR fit into that picture?
So if BDNF is the raw fertilizer, MTOR is essentially the brain's construction foreman.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, when the MTOR pathway is activated, it takes those raw materials and actually directs the physical building process. Together, they cause the brain to physically sprout new dendritic spines.
And those are the little branches on your neurons.
Exactly, the little branches. They form brand new synapses. You see, chronic depression literally withers away the physical connections in your prefrontal cortex.
It causes them to shrink.
Yes, it prunes them back. But this process forces the brain to rapidly rebuild the very bridges that depression destroyed.
Okay, hold on. I have to play devil's advocate here for a second because the logic feels fundamentally twisted.
Right.
You just said glutamate is the brain's main excitatory chemical. It makes the brain active.
Right.
So if these drugs are blocking the main glutamate receptor, the NMDA receptor, shouldn't that shut things down? How does blocking an excitatory receptor somehow cause a massive downstream surge of excitation and brain growth?
It is a brilliant paradox, and honestly, it's exactly what stumped neuroscientists for years.
I can imagine.
The answer to your question lies in a concept called the disinhibition hypothesis.
Disinhibition, taking away the inhibition.
That's the key. You see, ketamine and nitrous oxide don't just block any random NMDA receptors across the board. They have a preference. They specifically target and silence the NMDA receptors sitting on a very particular type of inhibitory neuron called a GABA interneuron.
Okay, GABA interneurons.
You can think of these GABA interneurons as the brakes of the brain. They constantly hum along, keeping the surrounding brain activity calm and regulated. So when the drug blocks the receptors on those specific inhibitory neurons, you are essentially taking the brakes off.
Ah, I see. You're inhibiting the inhibitors. You're putting the brakes on the brakes.
Precisely. And when you remove the brakes, the nearby excitatory neurons are suddenly unleashed. They fire uncontrollably, flooding the prefrontal cortex with that massive wave of glutamate, which hits the AMPA receptors, brings in the BDNF fertilizer, alerts the MTOR construction foramen, and starts rapidly growing those new synapses.
That is an incredibly elegant biological loophole.
It's beautiful, really.
But it also leads to a pretty obvious assumption. If ketamine and nitrous oxide both use this exact same disinhibition loophole to grow new synapses, then as a patient sitting in a clinic, the experience of taking them should feel identical.
And that assumption is precisely where the story takes a sharp left turn.
I figured.
Because while they might use the exact same key to unlock neuroplasticity, the physical reality of how these two drugs behave inside the human body could not be more different.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the contrast the OOKW journal paints between these two physical journeys is staggering. Let's look at ketamine first. The article describes it as a pretty messy chemical process.
Very messy.
It's an injectable drug or nasal spray, and it's heavily metabolized by your liver. It sticks around in your system for hours.
Yeah.
But it's not just one clean molecule doing a job. The source mentioned it's a mix of different things, like enantiomers, and it breaks down into a whole soup of other active chemicals.
That chemical soup is a great way to think about it. Ketamine is composed of enantiomers, specifically S-ketamine and R-ketamine. These are basically mirror image versions of the same molecule, like a left and right glove, and they interact with the brain's receptors with slightly different affinities. Esketamine, which is just the isolated S version, is actually the more potent NMDA blocker of the two.
The article also highlighted a specific byproduct it breaks down into, a metabolite called HNK. And it seemed like researchers were arguing over whether HNK is actually doing the heavy lifting.
That is a massive area of ongoing debate right now. Hydroxynorketamine, or HNK, lingers in the body long after the initial ketamine has been broken down.
Oh, I see.
Some researchers argue that HNK might be driving a significant portion of those antidepressant synapse-growing effects completely independently of the NMDA receptor.
Wow, so it might not even be the primary block doing it.
Exactly. It adds this thick layer of complexity. And because of this heavy, lingering metabolism, the experience for the patient is profound and intense. It produces deep dissociation, a severe detachment from your body and reality.
Which people know about.
Right. At higher clinical doses, patients can enter what's widely known as the K-hole. It requires sitting in a clinic for hours navigating a heavy psychological journey.
Now compare that intense lingering journey to nitrous oxide.
Nitrous oxide is practically an alien substance compared to ketamine. First and foremost, it's an inhaled gas, and it possesses a blood gas partition coefficient of roughly 0.47.
Okay, we definitely need a translation on that one. What does a 0.47 coefficient actually mean for someone sitting in a chair breathing it in?
It means it is among the fastest acting drugs in all of medicine when it comes to entering and exiting the human brain.
Really?
Because that specific number is so incredibly low, the gas equilibrates in your lungs, transfers into your blood, and crosses into your brain in a matter of seconds.
Oh, that's incredibly fast.
And the kicker is its metabolism. Unlike ketamine's messy chemical soup, nitrous oxide has almost zero metabolism in the body. You inhale it, it triggers that NMDA blockade, and then you exhale it completely unchanged.
It's basically a ghost. Ketamine is a slow, digesting, heavy meal that breaks down into active byproducts that camp out in your system. But nitrous oxide enters the room, flips the neuroplasticity switch on the wall, and vanishes out the window before you even realize it was there.
That's exactly it.
The dissociative wave it causes is much milder, mostly just a lightheaded floatiness, right? And the moment you take the mask off and breathe room air, the effects clear almost instantly.
And we can't skip over the strangest biological quirk of this gas. Nitrous oxide is a genuine multi-target molecule.
That's so.
Well, while ketamine is highly focused, nitrous oxide actually recruits the body's endogenous opioid system. Its pain-killing properties actively trigger the release of opioid peptides in the brain. We know this because its analgesic effects can actually be blunted by administering naloxone.
Wait, hold on. If naloxone works on it, you're telling me this 18th century laughing gas is somehow hacking the brain's opioid system in a matter of seconds?
It's a completely bizarre trait for a simple inhaled gas, but yes, it is touching dopamine receptors, potassium channels, GABA receptors, and the opioid system all simultaneously.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, why does this physical difference, the hours-long chemical soup versus the 10-minute ghost, actually matter for a patient desperate for depression and relief?
It matters deeply because it dictates the reality of the altered state the patient must endure to get the clinical benefit.
Right.
With ketamine, you are asking a severely depressed, often fragile patient to commit to hours of deep, sometimes frightening psychological detachment. It requires a significant time commitment, a dedicated clinic, and real psychological readiness.
It's a heavy lift.
It is. But with nitrous oxide, you are delivering the exact same biological instructions to the brain to grow new synapses, but the subjective altered experience is compressed into a tiny window. It is a drastically lighter burden on the patient's immediate lived experience.
So if nitrous oxide enters and exits so cleanly compared to ketamine's heavy footprint, you'd assume it would be the obvious choice for doctors. But if we look at what you can actually get prescribed today, it's a completely different story.
Completely different.
The clinical scoreboard is totally lopsided. Now, the article points out they both share one glaring clinical weakness, durability. They are incredibly fast, but they fade.
Unfortunately, yes.
Both drugs can pull someone out of a depressive episode in 2 hours, but that relief generally only lasts about 1 to 2 weeks. They are rapid rescue operations, not permanent fixes. They demand ongoing maintenance.
That is the tragic irony of the rapid-acting antidepressant space. Speed is their greatest miracle, but going the distance is where both of these molecules stumble.
But the way the medical establishment has responded to that hurdle is day and night. Ketamine absolutely dominates the psychiatric space right now. Esketamine, which we mentioned earlier and is marketed under the brand name Spravato, has been FDA approved since 2019.
Yes, it's very established.
But the OOTW Journal highlights a massive milestone that just happened in January 2025. The FDA approved Spravato as the first standalone monotherapy for treatment-resistant depression. The article noted it showed a 22.5% remission rate at week 4. Plus, you have regular IV ketamine being used off-label in hundreds of clinics across the country.
That 2025 approval cemented ketamine's massive established clinical infrastructure. It is a validated frontline medicine. Nitrous oxide, conversely, remains entirely investigational when it comes to depression.
Just a few trials, right?
Exactly. Its clinical story is largely resting on the shoulders of small pioneering trials led by a researcher named Peter Nagel. He ran the initial proof-of-concept trial back in 2015 and followed it with a critical Phase 2 trial in 2021.
The article spent a lot of time on that 2021 trial, specifically regarding the patient experience. I mean, imagine being the patient in that early 2015 trial. You want the rapid relief, you want the brain fertilizer, but they were giving patients a 50% concentration of nitrous gas, which caused severe nausea and vomiting. That sounds miserable.
It was a major barrier. The key breakthrough of Nizal's 2021 trial was a dosage discovery.
Find the sweet spot.
Yes. His team found that if you drop the concentration to just 25% nitrous oxide, it matched the antidepressant benefits of the higher dose perfectly, but drastically reduced the nausea or side effects.
Oh, wow.
Finding that 25% sweet spot proved there is a plausible, tolerable way to administer this. But even with that discovery, a 2025 meta-analysis confirmed that the entire case for nitrous oxide currently rests on a very small handful of short-term trials.
Let me ask a grounding question here on behalf of anyone listening who might be seeking help. Is it even a fair fight to compare these two right now?
That's a fair question.
I mean, one has an FDA rubber stamp, massive clinical infrastructure, and a huge 2025 milestone as a standalone therapy. The other is a very promising but small experiment on a handful of patients breathing from a gas tank. Can we really call this a race?
It's vital that we validate that skepticism because you are entirely correct. If we are talking about a medical contest for which treatment you can walk into a doctor's office and receive today, the race is over.
Ketamine wins.
Ketamine wins. It is an approved, widely available medical treatment. Nitrous oxide is absolutely not an approved treatment for depression.
So why compare them?
What this journal article is doing is an educational comparison of mechanisms. It's about understanding how the human brain responds to drastically different tools that hit the exact same receptor. We aren't comparing their current market share. We are comparing their underlying biological potential and what they teach us about the limits of neuroplasticity.
Fair enough. It's about the science of what's possible. But wait, I have to circle back to something. I mentioned that 22.5% remission rate for ketamine earlier.
Right.
To a layperson like me, a 22% success rate sounds like you're failing nearly 80% of the time. Why is that considered such a massive victory by the FDA?
You have to look at the specific population in those trials. These are patients with treatment-resistant depression.
Oh, so they've tried other things.
By definition, these are individuals who have already tried multiple traditional SSRIs, therapy, perhaps even older classes of drugs, and nothing has worked. Their depression is entrenched. In that specific, highly resistant population, getting nearly 1 in 4 people into total remission, not just improvement, but remission within 4 weeks as a standalone therapy, is a monumental statistical achievement in psychiatry.
That context changes everything.
Exactly.
Okay. So while the clinical efficacy and approval might be totally lopsided in favor of ketamine, there is one critical area where both of these drugs are unfortunately on very equal footing. They were both highly accessible to the public outside of a doctor's care.
And that is where things get complicated.
Very. And that brings us to their vastly different and honestly terrifying safety profiles. We're looking at a tale of two toxins.
The nuance here is absolutely critical. You cannot simply draw a line and label one of these as the safe drug and the other as the dangerous one. As the OTW piece maps out, their hazard curves go in completely different directions. They threaten the human body in fundamentally different ways.
Let's start with ketamine's risks.
Yeah.
The dangers of ketamine are heavily concentrated in chronic repeated exposure. It is a Schedule 3 controlled substance for a very good reason. Carries real abuse liability.
Yes, it does.
And this has become a much sharper issue recently. The article notes that the DEA extended telehealth prescribing flexibilities all the way through the end of 2026. So getting ketamine delivered to your home is easier than ever.
The primary medical concern with widening access to at-home ketamine is that heavy, sustained, unmonitored use leads to very specific physiological destruction. The most prominent danger is severe bladder toxicity, known clinically as ketamine-induced ulcerative cystitis.
Which sounds incredibly painful.
It is agonizing. The metabolites of ketamine irritate the bladder lining. Over time, it causes extreme urinary frequency, intense pelvic pain, and in severe cases, irreversible scarring and shrinkage of the bladder wall.
That's awful.
And combine that chronic risk with the acute spikes in blood pressure and heart rate that occur during the actual dosing experience, and you have a drug that exacts a heavy compounding toll on the body if it is misused over time.
Okay, so that's ketamine's heavy footprint. Nitrous oxide, on the other hand, has an entirely different risk profile, which frankly, blew my mind when reading this. In a clinical setting, administered with oxygen under medical supervision, it is incredibly safe.
Very safe.
It has a 175-year track record in dentistry and obstetrics to prove it. But outside the clinic, the source material details an urgent escalating recreational crisis that peaked between 2024 and 2026.
The galaxy gas trend.
Yes, driven by the massive commercial availability of flavored nitrous tanks, branded as galaxy gas. And the specific biological danger of abusing nitrous oxide recreationally is terrifying. The article refers to it as the B12 trap.
The B12 trap is one of the most insidious chemical reactions you will find in all of toxicology.
Break that down for us.
When a person inhales heavy, repeated amounts of recreational nitrous oxide, the gas enters the bloodstream and physically interacts with vitamin B12. Specifically, it irreversibly oxidizes the cobalt atom sitting right at the center of the B12 molecule.
So it essentially rusts the core of the vitamin floating in your blood.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. It changes the valence state of the cobalt, which instantly inactivates the B12, and here is why it's a trap. If that user goes to a doctor feeling unwell, and the doctor orders a standard blood panel, their vitamin B12 levels will likely come back looking completely normal.
Because the physical vitamin is still floating there in the blood, so the test counts it.
Exactly. But it is functionally dead. It is entirely useless to the body. And your body desperately needs active, functioning vitamin B12 to maintain your myelin.
Myelin being the protective sheath, the insulation wrapped around your nerve fibers and your spinal cord.
Correct. Without active B12 to maintain it, that insulation begins to degrade and disintegrate. This leads directly to a neurological condition called subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord.
Which is just as bad as it sounds.
It starts with peripheral neuropathy tingling, and numbness in the hands and feet progresses to a loss of motor control and balance. And if not caught and treated with massive B12 injections, it can cause permanent, irreversible nerve damage and paralysis.
So what does this all mean? If you're listening and trying to weigh the reality of these two powerful substances, the contrast is stark. Ketamine abuse is like a slow accumulating tax. It's a visible, painful deterioration that eventually bankrupts your bladder and strains your cardiovascular system over time.
Right.
But recreational nitrous oxide, that is like a hidden trap door. It doesn't destroy the nerves directly. It quietly unplugs the B12 vitamin your body needs to maintain them, so your spinal cord slowly loses its insulation without you even realizing the catastrophic damage is being done until you literally can't feel your legs.
This raises an important question about the role of sedating and oxygenation in medicine. The great paradox of nitrous oxide is that the exact same gas, safely mixed with oxygen and given to a dental patient to ease their anxiety for 30 minutes, can quite literally put a chronic recreational user in a wheelchair.
It's all about context.
Medical supervision, strict dosage limits, and supplementary oxygen are the only things separating a vital, historic anesthetic tool from a crippling neurotoxin.
It really puts the responsibility squarely back on the medical community and on regulatory bodies to figure out how to harness the power of these molecules safely. Because as we wrap up this deep dive, the core lesson we have to take away is profoundly hopeful, despite the severe risks of misuse.
Absolutely.
If you are struggling, we now know that the depressed brain doesn't just have to rely on those slow cargo ship shifts in serotonin that we talked about at the beginning. By targeting that NMDA receptor loophole, we can force the brain to rapidly grow new connections.
The biological mechanism of rapid neuroplasticity is incredibly sound. Whether you reach that NMDA receptor via ketamine, an injectable with a lingering heavy footprint and a massive clinical head start, or nitrous oxide, the ghost-like breath of gas that requires far less psychological endurance, the brain's capacity to rebuild itself in a matter of hours is a proven reality.
That's amazing.
The challenge of the coming decades won't be proving to the world that these drugs work. It will be solving their heavy maintenance burden and mitigating the severe dangers of their misuse.
It's a reminder that we aren't looking at miracle cures. We are looking at powerful, deeply complex tools with very sharp edges.
And I'd like to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over, one that expands on everything the OTW Journal presented today.
Well, let's hear it.
If a 1960s battlefield anesthetic and a laughing gas synthesized all the way back in 1772 hold the biological keys to rapid neuroplasticity, it forces us to wonder, what other ancient, long-forgotten, or widely misunderstood molecules are sitting in plain sight right now, just waiting for the right scientific lens to unlock their potential for the human mind?
What an incredible question. We started today by comparing standard antidepressants to slow cargo ships and these unconventional drugs to rocket ships. It turns out we've had the rocket fuel sitting quietly in our medical cabinets for centuries. We're only just now learning how to fly the ship. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you. Keep looking for the hidden science in the everyday, and we will catch you on the next one.